Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.14, The April Uprising, Bulgarian Liberation, Part 3. At the dawn of 1873, the Bulgarian Revolutionary Central Committee was at a crossroads. Their great leader, Vasil Levski, had been hanged, and many of his comrades in Bulgaria had been sentenced to exile in remote parts of Anatolia, far out of touch from the other revolutionary émigrés who still survived. And there were still many great leaders of the BRCC living abroad, like Lubin Karavelov and Hristo Botev. But within Bulgaria itself, Vasil Levski had really been the indispensable man. Levski had personally stitched together a network of revolutionary committees, and these local committees had often pledged their loyalty to Levski personally, as his charismatic leadership and tireless work ethic had in many ways been the linchpin holding the entire thing together. So, when Levski was executed in February of 1873, the internal revolutionary organization based in Lovich, the Bulgarian wing of the BRCC through which Levski had been coordinating the activities of all the different local committees throughout Bulgaria, began to quickly unravel. Then, throughout 1873 and 1874, the BRCC would be forced to go underground as Levski's capture set off a wave of crackdowns against BRCC activities, with first Karavelov's newspaper, Freedom, being shut down, and then with Karavelov himself being forced to flee Bucharest for several months to hide from the authorities while things settled a bit. So this meant that not only was the BRCC's indispensable leader in Bulgaria, the chief apostle Levski, now dead, but the committee's official chairman and émigré leader, Karavelov, had now been forced to go on the run. And finally, their newspaper, which had been the primary public-facing organ of the BRCC, was now shut down. After Karavelov went into hiding, the 25-year-old Hristo Botev would gradually take control of the BRCC. And with his rise to prominence within the organization, a new cohort of revolutionary émigrés would begin to drive events. Like Botev himself, a good number of these émigrés were quite young, many of them being in their early to mid-20s, as opposed to Karavelov, who was in his early 40s, and Levski, who had been in his mid-30s before he died. Now, I bring this shift in the median age of the BRCC leadership up because the approach of the committee is going to become, for lack of a better way to put it, a bit more reckless. As we are about to see, this recklessness will lead to some unforeseen consequences, not all of them necessarily bad. And the BRCC's youthful recklessness could just as well be interpreted as like unwavering resolve and unyielding commitment to sparking a widespread uprising in Bulgaria. But this new youthful leadership of the BRCC will become important, because when the older Karavelov would eventually come out of hiding and return to Bucharest in 1874, he would largely be unable to reassert his control over the BRCC, and a split would develop between him and Botev that would go on to define the revolutionary scene leading up to the April Uprising of 1876. Essentially, two rival factions would emerge within the BRCC, with Karavelov's more hesitant followers believing that the conditions were not yet right for an uprising, making the argument that the revolutionary network in Bulgaria needed to be carefully rebuilt because, as we have just talked about, the death of Levski had severely disrupted this network. Karavelov argued that it would take time and patience to rebuild these connections, and that the pieces just simply weren't in place inside Bulgaria at this point. Karavelov also believed that outside support from an allied power such as Serbia or Russia was essential to the long-term success of Bulgarian independence. So he insisted that they should wait until the diplomatic situation was favorable for prompting an international intervention on behalf of the Bulgarians. On the other side of this split, the faction lining up behind Botev thought that all of this was hogwash. These younger and slightly more hot-headed revolutionaries believed that an uprising needed to be launched yesterday, and that the groundwork had already been laid, and that the conditions were already right. And as is probably apparent by the title of this episode, Botev's eager beavers will ultimately win out. And a big reason why the eager beavers will get their way is due to the efforts of a young man who will become very important in the Bulgarian story, Stefan Stambolov. Of all the BRCC leaders, Stefan Stambolov will kind of be the one guy to emerge out of the revolutionary period as a major national political leader within a liberated Bulgaria. And this is mainly because he was one of the few leaders to actually survive long enough to see a liberated Bulgaria become a reality. So Stefan Stambolov will end up being super important in charting the direction of Bulgaria in its first few decades as an autonomous nation. Stambolov is usually thought of as one of the principal founders of Bulgaria, and he will even get an entire era of Bulgarian history named after him, the so-called Stambolovština, during which he served as prime minister. But in 1874, Stefan Stambolov was just a fiery 20-year-old, joining the ranks of Botev's eager beavers, who were arguing for an immediate uprising in Bulgaria. Much like Hristo Botev, Stambolov had grown up within the world of early Bulgarian nationalism, and before he was born, Stambolov's father had actually taken part in an early rebellion against Ottoman rule in Bulgaria. So, having grown up in this family of proud Bulgarian nationalists, Stambolov joined in the revolutionary struggle at a very young age, and he would be involved in clandestine revolutionary activity from the time he was a teenager. Stambolov was then briefly educated in Russia, attending seminary in Odessa, and while living in Odessa, Stambolov would join up with the same scene of Russian Narodists that Botev had been a part of several years earlier. So, like Botev, Stambolov would be exposed to the Narodist brand of agrarian socialism, advocating for a classless society modeled off the idealized peasant commune. Though, Stambolov would not go on to profess the same socialist anarchist beliefs that Botev would, and Stambolov's political ideology would really be most defined by a fierce Bulgarian nationalism. But while attending seminary in Odessa, Stambolov would still get involved with this radical circle, and his association with the Narodists would get him into trouble in 1874, when a crackdown on young Odessa revolutionaries led to Stambolov's expulsion from the Russian Empire. While in seminary, though, Stambolov had already made contact with members of the Bulgarian Revolutionary Central Committee, and he had even flirted with the idea of trying to take Vasil Levski's place when the chief apostle was hanged in 1873. And though this initial attempt to lead the internal operations of the BRCC would not work out, once Stambolov was kicked out of his Russian seminary, he would flock to Bucharest to become a full-time revolutionary. Upon his arrival in the Romanian capital, Stambolov would quickly become close with Hristo Botev, as the two men shared an unwavering belief in the need for an immediate uprising in Bulgaria. Then, in 1874, Stambolov was chosen by the BRCC to be one of several members who were sent into Bulgaria as revolutionary apostles, following the work of Vasil Levski in spreading the revolutionary gospel amongst the population of Ottoman Bulgaria. So, during the day, Stambolov worked as a teacher in his hometown of Turnovo, while at night he conducted secret revolutionary activities for the BRCC. Though these secret activities would eventually be discovered by his superiors, and Stambolov would be fired. So Stambolov left Turnovo and traveled all around Bulgaria, fully dedicating himself to the work of an apostle, recruiting members, raising funds, setting up committees, attending secret meetings, and of course, participating in armed robberies and stockpiling weapons in preparation for a future uprising. In early 1875, Stambolov had arranged for a trunk of revolvers to be smuggled from Romania into Bulgaria. However, these revolvers were discovered by officials at a border checkpoint. These officials then traced the weapons back to Hristo Botev and Lubin Karavelov in Bucharest, and then also to Stefan Stambolov in Bulgaria. For Botev and Karavelov, the discovery of these revolvers led to a court case in Romania, and though the two Bulgarians would ultimately get out of these legal troubles, the court case would be messy and would further divide Karavelov and Botev, and so further entrench the divisions within the BRCC. For Stambolov, who was living in Ottoman Bulgaria, he was now a wanted man, and he would be forced to go on the run, donning a disguise, creating a fake identity, and acquiring a fake passport. Then he actually ran off to Constantinople, and while in the Ottoman capital, Stambolov would set up a meeting with the Russian ambassador, a man named Count Ignatiev. Now, Count Ignatieff is actually super important, and this will not be the last time he will appear in our story, as he will go on to be the primary Russian negotiator amidst the chaos of the Great Eastern Crisis. But at this point, Count Ignatieff was the Russian ambassador in Constantinople. And importantly for our story, he was also a huge proponent of a growing movement called Pan-Slavism. As we know, the Tsar had always seen himself as the natural protector of the Orthodox Christians in the Balkans, hence the Tsar's eventual defense of the Orthodox revolutionaries in Greece. But what made Ignatieff's Pan-Slavism different from the Tsar's solidarity with fellow Orthodox Christians was that Pan-Slavism was meant to intentionally stir up Slavic nationalism in places such as Serbia and Bulgaria, with the idea being that Russia would serve as the great world leader of a larger Slavic movement, sort of like what had been happening over in Germany under Otto von Bismarck, as Prussia had emerged as the powerful militarized leader of ethnic Germans. Ignatieff saw Russia as having a similar historical destiny, being the most powerful Slavic country. Well, knowing of Ignatieff's friendly stance towards the Slavic Bulgarians, the young Stefan Stambolov approached the Russian ambassador for help. And Count Ignatieff would offer his assistance to the young Stambolov by securing him a Russian passport, which would allow him to return to Bulgaria to continue his revolutionary work. But before parting ways, the two had a brief chat. And during their conversation, Count Ignatieff allegedly said to Stambolov, quote, "Russia can do nothing for Bulgaria now if the Bulgarians alone do not provide grounds for it." This advice from the influential Russian ambassador would stick with Stambolov and greatly influence his approach to achieving Bulgarian independence. Because from this point on, Stambolov would become convinced that independence could only be initiated by the Bulgarians themselves, and an uprising should therefore be launched in Bulgaria by the Bulgarians as soon as possible. Because following Count Ignatieff's logic, this uprising initiated by the Bulgarians would provide the Russians with the diplomatic grounds they would need to intervene. So, now equipped with this little piece of advice, and with a shiny new Russian passport, Stambolov would return to Bucharest, where he would join back up with Botev's eager beavers, who were still trying to push the BRCC towards an immediate uprising in Bulgaria. Then, shortly after Stambolov's return to Bucharest in 1875, Botev's faction, who stood in favor of immediate revolutionary action, would be greatly strengthened in their position due to a few different wider historical events. In the summer of 1875, the shocking news came that a massive uprising had broken out against Ottoman rule amongst the Serbs in Ottoman-held Bosnia-Herzegovina. Now, Bosnia holds an interesting place within Ottoman history, as it was one of the few areas where a substantial number of Slavs converted to Islam. And what this meant was that a population of Slavic Muslims had emerged in Bosnia, and many of these Slavic Muslims would constitute the ruling class of Bosnia. This religiously Muslim but ethnically Slavic ruling class would become known as the Beys, and over the years they had established a tyrannical and highly exploitative rule over the peasantry in Bosnia, which, by the way, included both Christian and Muslim peasants. So the ethnic and class structure of Bosnia really highlights the complex nature of power within the Ottoman Empire. Because the class divisions were not so easily divided into the powerful Turks versus the oppressed Serbs or Bulgarians. And much like in Greece, there were actually a lot of Christians who populated this ruling class of Bosnia alongside the Muslim Slavs, who had, yes, converted to Islam, but who also shared a Slavic language and culture. So, for many different broader structural reasons, Bosnia-Herzegovina, under the rule of these Slavic Beys, had become kind of a terrible place to live. This was due to a deadly combination of the oppressive land-owning Beys extracting as much from the peasants as they could, combined with an extensive system of tax farming, where tax farmers would extract even more from what little these peasants had left. Then, with the onset of the Tanzimat, Bosnia-Herzegovina became a real prototype for the way in which Ottoman reformers would make these far-flung promises, such as ensuring protections for Christians and putting an end to tax farming, but they would have no real ability to actually implement these reforms on the ground. And in many ways, this was because the local leaders, the Beys strongly resisted these reforms. So peasants and middle-class artisans would get word of these promised Tanzimat reforms and then find that, in fact, their situation was only getting worse. So in the summer of 1875, a group of Serbians living in Herzegovina launched an uprising in response to these horrific conditions. The Herzegovina uprising would thereafter spread to nearby Bosnia, and revolutionary activities would last for several years. When news of this uprising in Herzegovina reached the Bulgarian immigrants living in Bucharest, the debate over when to launch an uprising in Bulgaria was dramatically heightened as Botev, Stambolov, and their followers began pointing to this uprising in Herzegovina as proof positive that the conditions were already there for a successful uprising to take place in Bulgaria. Karavelov, for his part, continued to push back against this position, arguing that a lot more preparation still needed to happen on the ground in Bulgaria before a successful uprising could take place. But the Herzegovina uprising once and for all turned the tide in favor of Botev and Stambolov, and Botev would use his increasing popularity to make a move against Karavelov, and he forced the old-timer to officially resign from the BRCC. And with the removal of Karavelov, the last of the voices arguing for slow preparation were, for all intents and purposes, gone. And the BRCC will now become fully committed to an immediate uprising in Bulgaria. And this is when Stefan Stambolov's star really began to rise, as he was chosen by the BRCC to lead this uprising in Bulgaria, which it had been decided was to be launched in the city of Stara Zagora in central Bulgaria. This 1875 revolt, which would become known as the Stara Zagora Uprising, would ultimately serve as a prelude to the much bigger and much more significant April Uprising that would break out 8 months later. And the reason why it was just a prelude was because it was just not that well thought out. Hristo Botev and Stefan Stambolov fervently believed that conditions were right for an uprising, but they would ultimately be proven wrong in this assumption for a few different reasons. First off, Botev and Stambolov believed that Serbia would declare war on the Ottomans any day now, in response to the Herzegovina uprising because the revolt had been launched by a bunch of Serbs. I mean, the Serbian government had been secretly providing weapons to Serbian rebels in Bosnia-Herzegovina for quite a long time now. And the grandson of the Serbian revolutionary, Karađorđe, had actually gone to Herzegovina to join up with the rebels. So Botev and Stambolov took all of these signs to mean that Serbia would inevitably declare war on the Ottomans. But in this belief, they kind of misunderstood the nature of Serbian politics, because while there was widespread popular outcry in Serbia clamoring for war against the Ottomans in support of the rebels, the current ruling prince of Serbia was Prince Milan, member of the Obrenović line, cousin to our old friend Prince Michael, who was now dead, and rival of the Karađorđe dynasty. And Prince Milan was, for his own reasons, fervently against this war. The other misconception of Botev and Stambolov was that they believed that the Herzegovina uprising had begun to create a crisis atmosphere that could be leveraged by the Bulgarians to prompt Russian intervention into the Balkans. As we will see, this assumption will also prove to be wrong, at least for the time being, as exemplified by the fact that Russian ambassador Count Ignatiev, who was really Bulgaria's biggest cheerleader amongst Russian leaders, had sent a letter to the BRCC urging them not to launch an uprising because Ignatiev felt conditions were not yet right. But Botev and Stambolov ignored and/or misread these signs and went ahead with the uprising, mostly because they held this somewhat irrational belief that the people of Bulgaria would all just magically flock to their cause once an uprising had been initiated. But we've already seen this play out with the Cheti war bands that were sent into Bulgaria some 10 years earlier under the leadership of Georgi Rakovsky. Now, Vasilevsky had recruited many more Bulgarians to the revolutionary cause during his time as leader of the internal revolutionary organization. However, Levski had carefully established a communication network amongst the revolutionary committees scattered throughout Bulgaria. Since Levski's death, this communication network had not really been maintained, so when Stambolov went ahead with his uprising in Stara Zagora in September of 1875, Basically, no one heard about it outside of the area immediately surrounding the city. So, much like the Chetty attacks of old, the Stara Zagora uprising failed miserably in its effort to spark any widespread resistance, and it remained primarily a local movement and was therefore very quickly suppressed. Now, this uprising was a bit bigger than the old Chetty attacks of the 1860s, as close to 1,000 people joined up with the revolutionaries. But these 800 or so rebels were in small, scattered groups, and they were easily isolated by Ottoman forces who vastly outnumbered them. So, the Stara Zagora uprising was kind of a train wreck, and its only immediate result was the arrest of over 500 people, many of whom would be executed or tortured. The wily Stefan Stambolov, for his part, was able to avoid arrest, and he would escape back to Romania. And once he made it to Bucharest, Stambolov and the BRCC would go straight back to planning another uprising, and they would hold an assembly whose primary purpose was to try and figure out exactly what had gone wrong in Stara Zagora. And during this assembly, a lot of the blame for the failures of Stara Zagora were pinned on Hristo Botev, as he had been the most vocal advocate for the uprising. Now kind of being positioned as the scapegoat, Botev would be forced to resign from the BRCC in shame. So Botev would follow his old rival, Garavelov, into forced retirement, which meant that the two men who had most defined the BRCC in the years following Levski's death were now out of the picture. As we will see, Hristo Botev will make somewhat of a comeback during the April uprising. But for now, leadership of the BRCC had shifted to Stefan Stambolov. So, in November of 1875, just over a month after the catastrophe at Stara Zagora, Stambolov and a handful of other BRCC members reconvened in the Romanian town of Gheorghiu, which sits just across the Danube River from Bulgaria. In Gheorghiu, and I think I'm saying that right, these revolutionaries created a new committee called the Assembly of the Apostles. Following in the footsteps of the great Vasil Levski, this Assembly of the Apostles divided Bulgaria into five different revolutionary districts, and each of these districts was assigned a lead apostle and two assistant apostles who were to go stir up support for an uprising scheduled to be launched that upcoming spring. So in the winter of 1875-1876, these revolutionary apostles went to their assigned Bulgarian districts and began to stockpile weapons, connect with sympathetic communities, and just generally try and foster favorable conditions for a successful uprising. So we can see that Stambolov and company had learned a thing or two from Stara Zagora, because they were now putting in a real concerted effort to reconstruct Levski's revolutionary network in Bulgaria. But they were still kind of being eager beavers, because they only gave themselves about 2 or 3 months to lay the groundwork for an uprising. Levski, for his part, had spent years traveling around Bulgaria setting up committees. And just before he was executed back in 1873, Levski had very tellingly expressed to the BRCC leaders in Bucharest his belief that even then, at the height of his revolutionary work, he felt that conditions were still not yet right for an uprising. So, this Assembly of the Apostles is definitely following in the footsteps of Levski with their unyielding belief that a successful uprising in Bulgaria could and should take place. But they prove themselves to not really possess Levski's ability to comprehend the bigger picture. And honestly, they also just didn't have Levski's same charisma or methodical drive to patiently do all of the mundane network building that really needed to happen. But with all that said, the Assembly of the Apostles had marked down early May as the date for a future uprising, and the apostles had been sent out to the different revolutionary districts to lay the groundwork for this impending revolt. Now, a lot of what is about to happen is going to sound pretty familiar, because the April uprising is going to play out pretty similarly to the Greek Revolution, with the biggest difference being that while the Greek War of Independence was a very long and drawn-out conflict, lasting a grueling 8 years, the liberation of Bulgaria is going to be compressed within a very short period of time, with only 2 years between the launching of the April Uprising and the establishment of the Autonomous Principality of Bulgaria. So, as we move through the dramatic events of the April Uprising and its aftermath, we'll be doing some comparing and contrasting with the Greek Revolution, because, well, the similarities are too striking not to point out. And plus, these similarities will highlight the shared struggles of these revolutionaries and also expose the endemic issues that continued to plague the Ottoman Empire throughout the entire 19th century. So, the first similarity we see is that much like the initial revolt in the Peloponnese, the April Uprising would ultimately be launched prematurely and quite haphazardly. After all of the Bulgarian apostles had been sent out from their headquarters in Gyurgyu, they each traveled to their respective revolutionary districts and began active preparation for an uprising. This preparation included collecting weapons and ammunition, and famously, many apostles would construct cannons out of the trunks of cherry trees. And though the cherry tree cannons are an enduring symbol of the April Uprising, as you might expect, these cannons would not work particularly well, and they would mostly just kind of blow up after being used a couple of times. And the fact that the rebels were having to resort to making cannons out of trees actually nicely highlights just how outmatched the rebels are about to be. I mean, their artillery will literally consist of non-functioning cherry tree cannons. Along with this hoarding and constructing of weapons, the apostles also begin to spread the news of an impending revolt. And while spreading the word, they would use a real Felicia Tyria classic as they went around spreading rumors of an impending Russian invasion. So yeah, much like our old friend Alexandros Ypsilantis, Stefan Stambolov and his fellow apostles are going to go around and use false rumors of Russian support to bring people over to their side. But of course, as we have seen, the Russian ambassador, Count Ignatieff, had just told the BRCC not to launch an uprising. But even though there was no reason to believe that a Russian invasion was imminent, this active preparation and spreading of rumors in the winter and spring of 1876 did begin to create a crisis atmosphere throughout much of Bulgaria. And so far, it was looking like things were kind of going according to plan. And in mid-April, another general assembly was held in the remote mountain town of Oborishte. At this assembly, the delegates officially decided that May 1st would be the date when a general uprising would be launched, the idea being that all of the apostles would simultaneously rise up in each of their revolutionary districts, and in this way they would create the mass uprising that Bulgarian revolutionaries had been trying to cultivate for over a decade now. Within each revolutionary district, the general plan was to launch attacks against Ottoman authorities by doing things like attacking police stations, sabotaging train lines, burning and looting the properties of elite Muslims, and then just generally attacking anyone who resisted the uprising. And now, it is important to take a second to highlight this last point, because the BRCC had always tried to make a clear distinction between Turks, whom they viewed as a fellow nationality or ethnic group, and Ottomans, who represented the oppressive authorities who had subjugated and exploited the Bulgarians for so many years. Because the Ottoman authorities were not always Turks or even always Muslim. As we've seen, in the Balkans, there were many tax farmers, bureaucrats, landowners, and so on who were Christian and Slavic. So it was never as simple as Bulgarian versus Turk, and many leaders of the BRCC recognized this fact. And this really points to the influence of Levski, because before he died, he had long been a vocal advocate for making Bulgaria into a multi-ethnic republic, in which people of all religions and ethnicities would enjoy equal rights as citizens. Now, once the fighting in the April Uprising actually breaks out, things are going to get real messy, and a lot of these careful distinctions will go out the window in the heat of battle. But the Assembly of the Apostles would at least attempt to ensure the safety of both Christian and Muslim civilians who did not resist the revolutionaries. So at the Oborishte Assembly, this effort to protect civilians was made by designating safe houses for both Christians and Muslims. Though, of course, we must keep in mind that while these safe houses were meant to protect the lives of Muslims, this protection was needed because the rebels planned to burn down entire Muslim villages as part of the uprising. After plans were laid at Oborishte, the apostles once again famously swore on a Bible, a knife, and a revolver to selflessly sacrifice themselves in pursuit of Bulgarian liberation. Then, the delegates left the assembly and headed back to their revolutionary districts. But things began to veer off course almost immediately, when one delegate did not head back to his revolutionary district, but instead went straight to the Ottoman authorities. And just like that, all the careful efforts to keep these plans secret so that the Ottomans would be caught off balance by a surprise attack went out the window. And after the authorities got wind of this planned uprising, they made their first move by attempting to arrest a town notable from a village in central Bulgaria who had been selected as a deputy apostle and whose name had been betrayed to the Ottomans. Once this man got wind that he and his comrades were about to be arrested, the town notable made the fateful decision to launch the uprising 2 weeks early. So on April 20th, 1876, these rebels surrounded their local police station and attacked it, officially launching the April Uprising. This attack was initially successful, and the rebels took the police station and freed their comrades who were being held there. Then, the town notable who had led the attack famously wrote the so-called Bloody Letter, in which he notified the lead apostle of his revolutionary district, a man named Georgi Benkovsky, that he had officially begun the uprising. The reason that this letter is called the Bloody Letter is because it was signed using the blood of the local Ottoman governor who had been killed during the initial attacks. So yeah, these guys are not messing around. Then, the man who delivered this bloody letter allegedly rode his horse so fast that the poor beast died, and the messenger had to travel the rest of the way just running. But the letter would reach the lead apostle, Georgi Benkovsky, within a couple of hours. And after receiving this letter written in blood, Benkovsky quickly put together a Cheti warband of around 200 fighters, and they rode throughout the 4th Revolutionary District of Plovdiv, launching lightning attacks on Ottoman authorities and spreading the word that the uprising was at hand. Due to the incredible speed with which Benkovsky's regiment moved throughout their region, they became known as the Flying Band. And as Benkovsky went around raising the alarm, more bloody letters were also sent to nearby towns and provinces. In this way, word of these initial revolts would spread, and the unrest began to fan out across the 4th Revolutionary District of Plovdiv. Within a few days, news that the uprising had been launched early would also reach the apostles of the 1st Revolutionary District around the city of Turnovo, where Stefan Stambolov was lead apostle. However, seeing as it was only late April at this point, Stambolov and his comrades had thought that they would have at least another week to prepare, so they were caught a bit off guard. But they scrambled their forces and planned to launch their own uprising in 2 days' time, in solidarity with their comrades over in Plovdiv. The problem with this plan, though, was that because there were already revolts happening around Plovdiv, the Ottoman authorities were beginning to make moves against the revolutionaries, and arrests began to be made in the 1st Revolutionary District. And this begins to highlight the consequences of the 4th District acting early, as the uprisings that would follow the initial revolts around Plovdiv would be launched very haphazardly. Because the apostles were not only underprepared, but they had also completely lost the element of surprise. And honestly, the authorities would now always be one step ahead of them. And this brings us to really what would be the biggest difference between this revolt in Bulgaria and the Greek revolt in the Peloponnese some 50 years earlier. You may remember that a big reason why, really the reason why, the Greek revolutionaries had been able to take the Peloponnese was because the Ottoman military garrisons had been cleared as troops were being sent off to face the rebellious Ali Pasha to the north. Well, the Bulgarians had thought that this same dynamic would play out as the Ottoman regular army was being deployed from Bulgaria into Bosnia-Herzegovina in order to suppress the rebellions happening amongst the Serbs. But the big difference here is that the Ottomans had learned a thing or two from past experience, and there were now backups in place. And these backups would come in the form of the infamous Başıbazouk. Now, we are going to talk a whole lot more next week about the Başıbazouk, but for now, just know that these are irregular Ottoman soldiers who were not paid by the Ottomans, but rather fought specifically for plunder. When the Ottomans were in need of additional firepower, the Başıbazouk would be deployed as backup. And in this case, the Başıbazouk were currently being organized in Bulgaria itself, because they were to be sent across the border into Bosnia-Herzegovina in order to help the regular army suppress the Serbian rebels. So, there were at this point tens of thousands of these Başıbazouk in Bulgaria preparing to cross the border, and it was not very difficult for the Ottomans to simply redirect these Başıbazouk who again were already in Bulgaria, and to use them to suppress the unrest amongst the Bulgarian rebels instead. And the moment when the Bashibazouk were unleashed on the Bulgarians was when the story of the April Uprising transitioned from one of heroic resistance to horrific tragedy. Because a defining characteristic of the Bashibazouk was that they had zero discipline. So they are going to embark on a ruthless campaign, pillaging Bulgarian towns and massacring their residents. And since there were tens of thousands of these Bashibazouk, the only way for towns to defend themselves was to collect enough funds to try and bribe the Bashibazouks to just move along and leave them alone. But this would only work for those towns whose wealthy notables were willing and able to fork over this money, and so many towns were left at the mercy of these ruthless Bashibazouk. Even with the Bashibazouk now being deployed against the Bulgarians, the rebels in the 4th and 1st Revolutionary Districts would score several victories and last a few weeks before ultimately being defeated. And it was at this point in mid-May that our old friend Hristo Botev re-entered the story. As we noted earlier, Botev had been driven out of the BRCC after the failed Stara Zagora uprising, so he was not present for the initial planning amongst the Assembly of the Apostles. However, some of the apostles of the 3rd Revolutionary District based in Vratsa had approached Botev to ask him for help in planning their uprising, and they eventually would appoint him as the leader of a small Cheti band. So when news finally reached Botev, who was living just across the border in Romania, that the uprising was already underway, Botev would lead a Cheti war band across the Danube. To get across the river, Botev's Cheti boarded an Austrian steamer, and they then quickly commandeered the vessel and used it to land in the 3rd Revolutionary District in Bulgaria. They would then march to the Revolutionary Center in Vratsa and lead an uprising there. And simultaneous with their attack, another uprising was flaring up at a nearby monastery under the leadership of the apostles already stationed in the 3rd Revolutionary District. However, as had been the case with the 1st Revolutionary District around Tarnovo, Botev's uprising in Vratsa had completely lost the element of surprise, and the Ottomans were ready for them. So the rebellion was quickly put down, with Botev himself being killed during the fighting, and so Bulgarian liberation gained yet another martyr. Even though revolts had ultimately broken out in 4 out of the 5 of the revolutionary districts, and even though these revolts represented by far the largest Bulgarian uprising to date, with over 10,000 rebels joining the fight, ultimately the April uprising was a tragic failure. The Bulgarian revolutionaries had taken their shot, but because the initial revolt had been launched 2 weeks before the planned start date, the uprising had played out haphazardly, and the Bashibazouk were ready to take on the rebels with their superior numbers. And ultimately, the rebels would be outnumbered some 10-1, so they never really stood any chance of winning. And the immediate result of the April uprising was widespread repression of the Bulgarian people, and the deaths of nearly every revolutionary leader, with the one exception being the wily Stefan Stambolov, who managed, once again, to escape, making it back to Romania, where he would lay low, lick his wounds, and wait for events to unfold. And some unexpected events are about to indeed unfold. Because while the April uprising had been a complete strategic failure in the short term, in the long term, it would precipitate a sequence of events that would ultimately lead the Russians to intervene on behalf of the Bulgarians. Because news of the atrocities committed by the Bashibazouk against the Bulgarians will make front page headlines in Europe and will create yet another humanitarian cause at Ottoman expense, as major public figures such as Charles Darwin, Victor Hugo, Fyodor Dostoevsky, Oscar Wilde, and Giuseppe Garibaldi will call on their governments to save the Bulgarians. And so, even though most of them would sadly not live to see it, the Bulgarian revolutionaries would ultimately succeed in their goal of prompting foreign intervention. And through this intervention, Bulgaria will finally be liberated from Ottoman rule.